This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Timothy Oliphant, stars in the FX series Justified as Deputy U.S. Marshal Raylan Givens. In the HBO series Deadwood, he starred as Seth Bullock, the sheriff of a lawless mining town. He was also in the films 60 Seconds and Live Free or Die Hard. Justified is based on several stories by Elmore Leonard. Last year, in the series premiere, Raylan Givens was a deputy U.S. Marshal based in Miami, but after forcing a drug dealer into a showdown and then shooting him, Givens was exiled to his hometown in Harlan County, Kentucky, where he continues to be based this season. Because it's home, he knows a lot of the people, including some of the people he ends up going after, like the white supremacists, the meth makers, and the oxy dealers. Let's start with a scene from Justified's current season, its second. Oliphant's character, Raylan Givens, is pursuing a sex offender and catches up with him at a gas station. While acting like he's filling up his car, Givens takes the gas hose, aims it at the suspect, drenching him in gasoline. The sex offender pulls out his gun, aims it at Givens, and Givens warns him it would be unwise to fire the weapon.
What the hell?
That's it now.
Whoa, okay, I'm just going to ask you one question. Do you know how a firearm works?
What?
The key word in firearm is fire. When the pin hits the cap, it makes the charge explode, meaning there's a spark, which should be of some concern to a man soaked in gasoline.
Yeah, that's bullshit. That spark's so far away from the gasoline.
You didn't finish school, did you, Mr. Dean? It's not the liquid that burns. It's the fumes. Now look. Normally, I would have just shot you myself the second you pulled, but I am doing my level best to avoid the paperwork and the self-recrimination that comes with it. The Lord knows you're the kind that makes it worth it and more. Come on, Jimmy. Can we just try to end this without you turning yourself into the human torch?
That's Billy Miller, along with my guest, Timothy Oliphant, in a scene from Justified. Timothy Oliphant, welcome to Fresh Air. Pleasure to have you here.
Pleasure being here. Thanks, Terry.
So I thought of this scene just the other day when I was filling up my car with gas and it overflowed onto my shoes.
Uh-oh.
And I was wondering, is it true that it's not the liquid, it's the fumes that catch on fire?
It is the fumes.
So that was truth that you were speaking.
You know, I had an electrician over at my house the other day telling me about my generator, saying, if you ever are using your generator, should there be an emergency, and it runs out of gas, don't just fill it back up with gas because it's hot and the fumes can catch on fire and you have a big problem.
Wow. Okay.
And I thought, you know what? I should have known that because I believe I said that on my television show, that it's the fumes.
How would you describe your character, Raylan Givens?
I try not to. You know, he's out there trying to make a living. You know, the thing that's very attractive about the character is this sort of, you know, the moral code of it all. You know, I always go back to that scene in our first episode that came from the short story where, you know, Raylan told a guy that you don't walk in someone's house unless you're invited. And at the same time, he gave somebody 24 hours to get out of town or he'd kill him. And that to me is kind of says everything you need to know about the guy.
Now, when you're dealing with a villain of any sort on the show, you're not only great with the witty retort, you also have this incredible ability with your eyes to stare the person down, to not blink, to literally not blink, or to stare in disbelief when they say something to you that you're going to try to not acknowledge how inappropriate it is. Do you think of your eyes as being one of your tools? And how conscious are you of how you use your eyes when playing a character who literally does stare people down?
I try not to be conscious of any of it. Usually it's not a good place to be. If I'm really aware of what I'm doing, it's not good. I more or less try to make the other person do all the work, and I'm really just trusting that process, you know.
What does that mean? I mean, you're trying to get the other person to do all the work.
Well, once somebody calls action, the place to be for me is out of my head. You know, that's the last place I want to be. So you're just working off the other person. You're just working off of them. Whatever you're doing for them, because of them. You know, it's always about the other. And so everything should come from that. And then, you know, when someone calls cut, if I can remember everything the other person did, then I'm fine. Does that make sense?
I think so. What did you do?
Come on, you know what I'm saying. I mean, so, you know, right? If I'm aware of everything I did, then I'm not very good at my job.
Right.
But if I can remember everything Margot did, if I'm in a scene with Margot and when they call cut, I think to myself, oh, when you did that thing with there and where you put that down, you didn't do that before. If I caught those moments, then I'm ready to move on. You know what I mean?
What did you do to get to know your character or the region that justified a set in, which is Harlan County, Kentucky?
Well, I read a lot. I mean, I read, first and foremost, I read the Elmore books. You know, I had a short story and two novels, and I read them all many times and continue to kind of read them and comb through them. And then since then, he told me to check out a book called Stinkin' Creek. He said, you should read that. He said, it's something I read before I wrote the story. So I read those things. I watched the documentary about Harlan, that wonderful, famous documentary. I did
about coal miners in Harlan County.
Yeah, Harlan County,
okay, USA.
USA.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I listened to it actually before I watched it, and then you know worked with the dialect coach. Well, I love the dialect, and it's just so fun.
What do you love about the dialect?
I don't know. Someone told me there's no difference between pin and pen. There's just pin and pin, and it just cracks me up. I haven't heard it before, so I was like, there you go. There's something to sink your teeth into.
So I think it's really important in a series to have a great opening scene, which you had in Justified, and I want to play that scene. So you're a deputy U.S. federal marshal working in Miami at this point, and you've given a guy from a drug cartel 24 hours to leave town. With just a couple of minutes remaining in that deadline, you find him sitting at a table in an Oceanside hotel restaurant. You tell him he has 2 minutes left to leave town. He invites you to eat with him. Then you remind him that time is running out.
1 minute.
A second ago, you said 2 minutes. What's going on here?
Time flies, huh?
You're a character. I was telling my friends this morning how yesterday you come to me and you don't get out of town in 24 hours, I'm going to shoot you on sight. Come on, what is that? They thought it was a joke. They started laughing.
You tell about the man you killed? The way you did it? Because I found nothing funny in that.
Maybe I should have killed you, huh? Maybe I made a mistake.
Well, we all have regrets.
Cut me a little slack here, okay? Does nothing count? Gotta let you live?
No. I'm giving you the same consideration right now. You can get up and go. 30 seconds.
So what are you gonna do? In front of all these people, you're gonna pull out a gun and you're gonna shoot an unarmed man?
You're unarmed, huh?
Hey, you got eyes. You see a piece on me?
20 seconds.
Okay.
10.
You know what? Seriously? You come and you interrupt my meal. You won't eat with me. This is bull. This is supreme bull.
So that was the opening scene from Justified with my guest Timothy Oliphant and Peter Green. Okay, so for our listeners who couldn't see that, the drug guy pulls his gun first, but you're quicker and you shoot him. Of course, in that scene in Miami, you're wearing your Stetson hat, your white Stetson hat, which you almost always wear. Mm-hmm. Why is that so important to the character?
The hat?
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure it is, but it looks kind of cool. And, I think there's, what I liked in the book was there was a spirit of Raylan putting on the hat and oftentimes the blue suit because he thought the occasion kind of called for it. It felt a little bit like he was aware that it was a uniform, and I think he thinks of himself as a bit of as an old-fashioned lawman. He likes to compare himself to the men from back when, and I think it was used really well in the books. I think with the show, it's kind of maybe it's a bit overused, but I think it's pretty cool at the end of the day.
I think it works. It makes the character look more iconic because he's wearing it more in the Western tradition.
The hat's kind of cool, but every time I see Elmore, he's like, "Don't be afraid to lose the hat." it's a gust of wind could pick up and just blow it away, and you never see it again.
Is that good for you? That you don't have to like hold on to it. Your character can survive without the hat.
You know what I liked about when he told me that, or what I took from it, right or wrong, was that I thought he was saying, don't be beholden to this thing that everybody's talking about. It's like I think what you're saying. I think that the trust that the character and the stories and those other things are. In the other day, more important than this silly hat.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Timothy Oliphant, the star of the FX series Justified. He was also in the series Damages and was one of the stars of the HBO series Deadwood. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Timothy Oliphant, and he plays a federal marshal in the FX series Justified. He also was one of the stars of the HBO series Deadwood, a Western that was set in a really dirty mining town. you played a sheriff in Montana who, hangs a man and then leaves town with his partner with the intention of starting a hardware store in this mining town, Deadwood, and ends up becoming the sheriff.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, fantastic. Like, who would want to go to this town to start a new life of, like, all the places you'd want to go to? Why would you go to this, like, horrible, dirty mining town with all these, like crude, filthy, nasty, violent men there?
It was a good show.
No.
that's why we went there, because we thought it would make good television. I don't know. I know that one of the wonderful things about that whole show was those were real people that those characters were based on, and that's what the guy did. And I imagine that it's opportunity. There's an opportunity to go and make a living and move west. So I think for that character, there was a feeling that he was going to try to start over and walk away from this other life.
Get away from the violence.
Exactly.
So how did you get the part on Deadwood?
Sometimes people aren't... is consciously aware of their decisions as they should be. That I auditioned for. I met with. It started with a meeting with David Milch, and Walter Hill was in the room as well.
David Milch was the creator of the series, and Walter Hill is a film director who directed the first episode of Deadwood.
Exactly. Yeah. So I went and met with David and sat down with David and Walter. I really didn't say much. I kind of went in there with the plan of I just listen and see if I could just fool these people into thinking I was this guy. So David talked on and on. I just stared at him. Totally, it completely worked. I was told afterwards he was a bit nervous about the whole meeting and a bit intimidated by it, and he wanted to know if I'd be interested in doing the show. And my wife and I got a good laugh out of the whole thing. But I did go in and read for the executives at HBO. I went in and read what I think was the opening scene of the first episode.
I love what you said about the audition, because your character in Deadwood and your character in Justified are both so good at that unblinking stare, that unbacking down stare. And you did that in the audition. That's great.
To be quite honest with you, it's not something I think maybe I'm better at it at this point in my life than I was. But I've always sort of admired and respected one's ability to be comfortable with other people's discomfort, or they're being comfortable making other people uncomfortable.
So what did you have to learn for the role, like riding a horse? Did you know how to do that
for Deadwood? Yeah, I did have to learn to ride. Milch had all these rodeo guys, I think, on his personal payroll. They were around. Some of them became characters on the show. Guys who ran, were bull riders and rode Broncos in the 70s and 80s. And I think he met one of them and thought, well, this is the kind of guy that would inhabit a town like Deadwood. And so he invited that guy to go round up a bunch of his buddies and move them out to California and just hang out. And I learned, those are the guys that would take me riding. So I'd go ride with all these ex-rodeo dudes around the hills of, out there by Griffith Park and stuff. And I learned how to ride, and I learned a lot of really bad jokes. And that was the deal. It was kind of fun.
What was the set for Deadwood like? Because the town that Deadwood is set in is just so grimy, like ugly, mean.
I love that set. I mean, that was one of the greatest sets I've ever been on. The whole thing was just very alive. I mean, it was a working set. I mean, it was unlike, it's very hard to come across that kind of a situation where the fact that it was such a self-contained world and that everything was available at our disposal, really at any given moment, it allowed David to, it's not fair to say he was winging it. I often use that word, but I mean, he's such he's writing everything at the last minute. He's writing everything the day before. You're getting your pages, 5 p.m., 6 p.m., you're getting pages, lots of them, that will shoot the following day. It wasn't uncommon for him to be on the set in a rehearsal and, he all of a sudden ask, are the Chinese here? Do we have any Chinese? It'd be great if we had some Chinese for this scene. And then, the ADs are scrambling on the phone. David, we could have the Chinese here within the next 3 hours. Perfect. Do we have anything else we can shoot until then? Yes, we could shoot the scene down at Bullock's house. Anna will be here in a few minutes. Perfect. Let's flip that. And we're going to go down the street and shoot that scene now. I'm going to rewrite this scene. It'll be ready in 3 hours. When the Chinese arrive, and it felt like a perfect storm of the set allowed him to kind of work that way without the challenges of being, we don't have this unjustified we're driving all around Southern California trying to find a location that we could call Kentucky, and it makes it much more difficult every time you kind of throw a wrench into things.
My guest, Timothy Oliphant, stars in the FX series Justified as Deputy U.S. Marshal Raylan Givens, and he played Sheriff Seth Bullock in the HBO series Deadwood. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor Timothy Oliphant. He plays Deputy U.S. Marshal Raylan Givens in the FX series Justified. When we left off, we were talking about starring in the series Deadwood, which ran on HBO from 2004 to 2006. He played Seth Bullock, the sheriff of a lawless mining town in South Dakota in the 1870s. Let's hear a scene from Deadwood, and this is a scene with you and Ian McShane. He played Al Swearengen, who ran a saloon and brothel and was one of the meanest, most unethical men you'd ever want to meet. So in this scene, you're talking to Swearengen, and you're talking about a widow's claim to a gold mine. You, Sheriff Bullock, suspect that Swearengen is going to try to cheat her out of her claim. So you start the conversation.
I'm here to talk about Mrs. Garrett.
The plant at her husband this morning?
I wrote a man about coming to assay her claim, but he can't make it.
Plenty of local alternatives.
I want you to nominate someone.
Do you?
So if any way his work was mistaken, I'd be coming after you.
You would?
Yeah.
Well, since I got nothing to do with the venture, what if I declined to make the recommendation?
Then you better hope whoever I find does his job right, because I'm still holding you accountable.
I ain't involved. E.B. Farnham offered on a claim.
Farnham's your water boy, and I know what you've been trying to do to her.
So here you come in all nobility, threatening me with a dire result if the property that widow's husband thought worthless and wanted sold turns out not to be pinched out.
You and I know how it is, Mr. Swearengen.
How what is?
She gets a square shake. Where I come for you.
What if I come for you? You ready for that?
I guess I better be.
Then close your store, because being ready for me will take care of your waking hours, and you better have someone to hand the task off to when you close your eyes.
We understand each other.
Well, one of the many great scenes from Deadwood, Timothy Oliphant, my guest, along with Ian McShane. It must have been fun working opposite Ian McShane. I mean, he played such a really hot character, like he's really overheated all the time, and you're like so cool. So you were great foils for each other. Can you talk a little bit about working off of him in scenes like that?
It was amazing. He was amazing. Just listening to that, I'm reminded how much I learned on that set. It's really striking, actually, listening to it. I, as far as Ian's concerned, before I, I just love him. He was great to work with. He's a good friend, and I really took so much away from that experience. He was so at ease and so relaxed and such a professional that he. You know, you saw he's like a little kid, you know, playing with the props and playing with the language. And it was, you know, he never lost the sense of the fun of it all. I feel like it was, I wasn't operating at that same level. I don't think I was, I think I was overwhelmed or going through the motions in a way that, I was less committed, fully committed to the work or to what you know, relying on, you know, people telling me what, thinking about what I'm supposed to do or what's expected or, and so in a way, in a way you're just battling fear, you know, you're acting defensively, you know, and I think that's the thing now that I can. You know, I've learned from those guys.
One of the things that became famous about Deadwood was the number of obscenities and the amount of blasphemous language that was used incessantly on the show. Mm-hmm. Did you and, say, Ian McShane in scenes opposite each other ever start laughing because the language was just so overloaded?
I mean, you tend to... you tend to crack up every time someone handed you the new pages. I mean, the first season, I remember daily running into, fellow actors and stuff and saying, did you read that? You know what I mean? Are they really going to let us shoot that? I mean, I'd never read anything like it before in my life. You would read something and just crack up because how far it pushed the boundaries of what you thought was okay to do on television. Or you read it and you thought to yourself, what the hell am I talking about? I don't know, understand any of this. You know, and you really had to kind of wrap your head around something. And then once you kind of have to break it down, and then you realize, no, it's really quite simple and quite perfect. And it was really quite special.
You know what I find interesting? There's so many actors now who are in action films or maybe a Western like Deadwood, or where so many actors have to learn how to shoot a gun and carry a gun because they're playing cops or private eyes or bad guys or cowboys or whatever. And I just think it's so odd. You know what I mean? That to be an actor now, unless you're in like a little independent film, and even in some of those, you're going to have to learn how to shoot. That's true
Why? Yeah, of course it is. But why is that odd? Is that not what has been making the drama go for? Isn't that what everything's always been about? I mean, what were they doing in the theater 100 years ago? They were learning how to sword fight and stuff, weren't they? I mean,
absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, this is the stuff that we want to kind of play out and try to get a handle on.
So being around guns a lot in your acting career, has that made you think about guns in real life at all?
I don't feel it's changed my point of view about them at all. I more or less still feel the same. I'd rather not have them around. And at the same time, there's always moments where you think, I wish I had a gun.
Do you think that?
Yeah, doesn't everybody think that?
I don't think I think that.
Every now and then you don't think to yourself, I wish I had a gun. You don't think to yourself like in some sort of, or if not a gun, aren't there moments where you think?
I'm the kind of person who thinks, I really wish I could defend my point of view more forcefully, or I wish I could have told the person off. I don't usually feel like, I wish I had a gun.
Well, I guess there lies the difference between you and I. I think that too. I'm with you. I sometimes think I wish I could have better represented my point of view more forcefully and whatnot. And then I think, and when that didn't work, I wish I had a gun.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
My guest is Timothy Oliphant. He stars in the FX series Justified, and he played Sheriff Seth Bullock in the HBO series Deadwood. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Timothy Oliphant, who is the star of the FX series Justified, and he was one of the stars of the HBO series Deadwood. Okay, so I don't know how you're going to feel about me quoting this, but in the March 2011, you know it's coming, in the March 2011 edition of GQ, no, it was Esquire. Was it Esquire or GQ that you were called?
I honestly don't know.
You were called America's Next Top Man Crush. And I confess I wasn't really familiar with the expression man crush, so I actually looked it up, and it said when a straight man idolizes another man but not sexually.
I'm not sure it deserved the word. But it's good that they gave it a word. Seems like something. Is Vince Vaughn? Is he being credited for that? It feels like something that Vince Vaughn.
Oh, might have originated. I don't know.
I don't know. Usually, whenever I hear something like that, I think two things. It's like something that Vince Vaughn must have said offhandedly somewhere, and two, some studio, if not three, have a film based on the title that they're trying to develop.
Right, right. I think it's part of the whole like bromance vocabulary.
That's right. See, there you go. Same thing.
Exactly.
So the question was, how do I feel about that? Is that it? Is that what you're wondering? Or
are
you just pointing out that it's there, that somebody wrote it down?
I think I might have just pointed it out, but you're right. How do you feel about that?
It has nothing to do with me. That's the good news. You know, those things are really, in the end of the day, it's not about me.
So, like when you were in high school, did you think of yourself as good looking?
Did I think of myself as good looking? I thought I had a pretty good shot, you know? That's what I think. I think I more or less went through high school trying to figure out if I could, pick up on that girl and that one. I thought, you know, if with the right grooming and if I don't say anything too stupid, wear the right pants, I've got a pretty good shot.
Earlier in your career, you were supposed to be in a remake of the TV series 77 Sunset Strip, which is a private eye series that ran from 58 to 64. And one of the stars was Ed Kooky Burns, who had that novelty record, Kooky Kooky, Lend Me Your Comb. And Clint Eastwood was producing this. Was this supposed to be a movie or a TV series?
No, this was my first job of any kind outside of lifeguarding. I moved to New York. I studied acting. My resume had a bunch of things I made up, you know, scenes I did in class and said that I'd done in some regional theaters or something. And I went in and read for the late Phyllis Huffman, who cast all of Clint Eastwood's movies. And I got the job. It was for the WB Network. Their first season, it was Warner Brothers was starting this new network. Clint had, as I understood the story, Clint, you know, his relationship with Warner Brothers is legendary, and so he was going to produce this show, and I was going to be the kind of the Ed Kooky Burns type character. It was a tribute to the show; it wasn't a remake. Some guy, Jim Caviezel, was the star. He was a guy who moved out to L.A. and started a detective agency and named it after his father's favorite television show, 77 Sunset Strip. Maria Bello was in it.
Uh-huh.
So I flew out to L.A. to shoot. We sat down at the table read. I was looking for Clint everywhere. He's nowhere to be seen. So when we finished the reading, I asked, where's Clint? You know, they said he quit. Apparently, you know, about 3-4 days of television network executives, he pretty much decided, you guys go ahead without me. And so that was it. But the show didn't get picked up.
Let me back up a couple of steps here. You said you made up things on your resume. You took scenes you did in your acting class and made it seem like you did them on stage in regional theater. Was there a little voice in your head thinking, maybe that's unethical, but maybe it'll get me a job?
Are you kidding? What am I supposed to hand in a resume that just says Timothy Oliphant, actor, experience, none? I was 20-something years old. I'm looking for work. People don't, you know, you got to make them feel a little comfortable. I've done something.
Were you afraid that someone would know, like, the New York theater scene and the regional theater scene so well, and they'd look at your resume and say, no, you didn't?
If I'm not mistaken, I know I'm not mistaken, because I have the book at home. I did, my first play of any kind was an off-Broadway production of a play called The Monogamist. And every year, this Theater World magazine in New York gives awards for outstanding debut performances for off-Broadway and Broadway. And I was I was given an award for my performance in The Monogamist. And in the book, in theater, they issue a book every year with the people who won the awards that year and all the previous years, for on and on and on. And the names are amazing. I mean, I've looked at them. It's just an incredible company of people that have been given these awards. And in there is, it says a bunch of plays that I had been in previously that I've never been in my life. It's in the book. But, you know, I don't know what they're doing these days, but that's what people did. You just, you know, you got to put something on there.
So I want to end with a clip from The Office, because you were on a couple of episodes of that.
And, I was. I had so much fun on that show.
Yeah, it must be a lot of fun to work on that show. Did they call you?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. Mindy Kaling.
She's a writer-producer and one of the stars.
Exactly. Exactly. I was about to say that's just, she's got way too much authority over there. That's quite the, I guess that's what I've tried to do on my show as well, so I shouldn't call her out on that. I'd run into her in public on occasion, and she'd say, oh, I just really want to have you on the show. And I remember, I think every time I saw her, I'd say, well, what's the holdup? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not the holdup. I'm free Tuesday. But anyway, this went on for years. And then, I don't know, a few months ago, I got a call saying, they've got this part. You know, do you want to do it?
So
I said, yeah.
Let's end with a scene. You played Danny Cordray, who's a good-looking paper salesman who's stealing clients from the Dunder Mifflin Paper Company. So Michael, Dwight, and Jim concoct the scheme to observe your sales techniques. They create a fake company. They put a fake company sign on their office door and invite you in to discuss selling paper to them. And that way they figure they can watch your techniques. And they have Meredith posing as a company representative. So at this point, Michael, played by Steve Carell, is talking with you, and Jim and Dwight are observing the interactions next door through a surveillance camera. And the scheme has just come apart. So you're kind of on to them, and Michael Scott is apologizing to you. And we're going to end our interview here with the scene. So I just want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
A great pleasure. And Timothy Oliphant stars on the FX series Justified. And here's the scene from The Office, starting with Steve Carell.
I owe you a most sincere and humble apology. We were trying to watch you to see your sales technique so we could stop losing so many clients to you.
Watch from where?
A surveillance room next to this one.
Okay, so you set up this fake company, then you hired this homeless woman to impersonate an executive to spy on me so that you could copy my sales technique.
Yes, and it's the sincerest form of flattery.
Or crazy.
Well,
I'm gonna go.
Okay, you know what? It wasn't just me. Jim and Dwight are behind that wall in the surveillance room, and it was their plan as well.
No. Oh, well then, yeah. All right, hey, good luck, guys. Seems like we got a great operation here.
No, we don't. Here's my point. Danny, listen, you have to understand that we are not normally like this. We wanted to know your tricks.
Tricks? There's no tricks, man. I'm just a good salesman. You want to copy that? You can't copy that.
You are. Stop it. You are a good salesman. And because of that, I want you to work for me.
Sure. You seem like a fun, professional guy.
So you will.
No!
Hold on. Wait.
That was Timothy Oliphant with Steve Carell in a scene from The Office. Oliphant now stars in the series Justified, which is shown on FX Wednesday nights. Middle Brother is a trio formed by members of other bands, John McCauley from Deer Tick, Taylor Goldsmith from Dawes, and Matthew Vazquez from Delta Spirit. The three friends have put together a collection of songs that rock critic Ken Tucker says reach across decades of rock, folk, and country music.
A Bloody Mary afternoon, waste my time out in the sun. Hum myself some melodies, maybe I could sing you one.
There's a singer-songwriter intimacy in many of the songs on Middle Brother, as though John McCauley, Taylor Goldsmith, and Matthew Vasquez were sharing secrets and anecdotes and decided to set them to music and share them with us. All three men belong to bands that trade on folk, blues, and country traditions. Even their up-tempo songs are less rave-up rockers than hand-clapping foot stompers.
Dehydrated from a double shot, get my nourishment from punching the gut. Never really felt I had the best of luck. I got a big, big mouth that just won't shut up. Hop in the car, turn the radio on. Out from the speakers, a familiar song. Head down the road, start to hum along. I made it all the way home and left the TV on. But I'm gonna learn to fly an airplane, and it's gonna make my mama proud. I'm gonna get my dad to notice me, even if I have to fly it into the ground.
This being a group composed of thoughtful guys with guitars, there's a certain amount of bad behavior to be chronicled. Bouts of drunkenness, hangovers, one-night stands, and a general air of doomstruck melancholy. Sometimes it's maudlin, but more often, as on Matthew Vasquez's song Theater, it can describe dreams with a precision that matches the sharp snap of the drumbeat.
I went to the theater, but nobody came.
That vocal sounded a little Neil Young-y, didn't it? We shouldn't be surprised. Middle Brother is less a band than a showcase for three separate sensibilities, each helping the other to achieve the sound he wants. The effect is strongly reminiscent of another group of disparate musicians coming together for what had been conceived at the time as a one-off project, Crosby, Stills, and Nash in 1969. It's probably no coincidence that when the band first performed publicly, they billed themselves as MG&V, just as Crosby, Stills, and Nash used CSN as their abbreviation. Middle Brother connects to that tradition, and perhaps tellingly, locates its best lyrics not from one of their own compositions, but courtesy of Paul Westerberg in their fine cover of The Replacements' Portland.
Shared a cigarette for breakfast, shared between a ghost and a walking bowl of punch. Can you play a little hunt? Predicting a delay on landing. I predict we'll have a drink. Lost my money on a first hand. Got burned on a big fat king. And your ears just want to ring. It's too late to turn back. Here we go. Portland. Oh, no.
If I had to give the nod to one Middle Brother above the others, it would be John McCauley. The Deer Tick singer's voice always cuts through any piece of music with a reediness that's razor sharp. Listen to the way he borrows a few bars from the Elvis Presley hit Don't Be Cruel to become rockingly self-absorbed on Me, Me, Me.
You kept me out of trouble as much as you could stand. Well, I don't blame you if he lies in your bed or puts eyes in your head. If he interrupts a feeling that he cannot comprehend.
Me on the floor. Although their press release says Middle Brother are young rock songwriters striving to carry on the tradition of Neil Young, Bruce Springsteen, and Tom Petty, it's pretty clear that so unassuming an album as this is never going to have the cultural or commercial impact of those men. Still, as a semi-supergrouping of cult indie faves, these guys have their hearts in the right place, even if their heads are in the clouds and their livers are in the bar.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the album Middle Brother from the group of the same name. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
When it hits me that she's gone, I think I'll run for president. Get my face put on the $1 million bill. So when these rich men that she wants show her ways they can take care of her, I'll have found a way to be there with her still.
When it hits me.